Welcome to Writer House Literary Salon.
Sunday, July 27th, 2014. The Risks and Rewards of Writing What You Don't Know. Author Josh Wheel talks to UVA Slavic Studies professor Andrew D. Kaufman about the challenges, both internal and external, of breaking far away from yourself in your fiction, and the ways in which doing so can bring you closer to your core project at the same time. He also mentions his relationship with Russian culture and his current fascination with humanity's efforts to bring light into darkness.
Everybody to Writer House. First, I want to thank James and Sharon Harrigan for sponsoring Josh's event here today. And our next event will be Sherry Reynolds on August 15th, which is going to be sponsored by Jody and Jeffrey Hessler. Today, we're happy to have Andy Kaufman, who is a professor of Slavic Studies at the University of Virginia, specializing in Russian literature. I thought would be sort of an interesting person to talk to Josh about his book, since it's been talked about as sort of Russian folktale meets dystopian near future. And Josh, this is Josh's second book. Those of you who were here a few years back may remember he was here when New Valley was published, which is a book of three novellas to a packed house also. And we have a few copies of this book, and then we also have copies of The Great Glass Sea, which is his new book. And we'll they'll have a little discussion a la Inside the Actor's Studio, and then we'll open it to questions from the audience. And then we have books here for purchase and signing. I'm going to turn it over to Andy. Thanks.
So I think Josh wants to start with a little reading from his book and a little synopsis of what the book's about, and then we'll launch into a conversation.
Sounds good. Just so you guys have, because I know everybody here has probably read my book already. But I figured anyway, no, I figured it would be good to have some idea of what the heck we're going to talk about. So the book it's called The Great Glass Sea, and it is, I think of it as a fraternal love story. It's essentially, the heart of it is about two brothers who grow up very, very close. They lose their father when they're young, when they're 9 years old. And their mother is so struck by grief and other things that she becomes really unable to care for them, and so they have to hold to each other as their rocks in this very all of a sudden unsettled world. So it's about their relationship, Yarik and Dima, they're twins. Yarik takes on the role of the older brother, even though he's just a few minutes older, and it's the way that a lot of the book takes place when they're both older in their 30s, and the way that adult life and the pressures of the modern world creep in between them and start to pry them apart, and their desperation to hold on to the relationship they had as children. So that's kind of the heart of the story. Just to make it interesting, it happens to be thrown in an alternative present in northern Russia. They're all Russian characters, springs from Russian fables, and this is a world where there's no darkness because there are space mirrors that send light down, carom light down from the sun into the dark corner of the world. All of which might sound somewhat crazy, but it did to me when I started writing it. But it is, all of those things just increase the pressures and on the struggle that the brothers are having. So for me, all of that, although it's very important to the novel, springs from the character needs. We'll maybe talk a little bit about that later. So with that, I'll go ahead and just read a little bit. I'll keep it pretty short. I'm going to try to go for about 5 to 7 minutes. So everyone get comfortable. The first chapter is called Niji. Start right at the beginning. I won't tell you anything to prep it because it's the first chapter. So, Niji. Always the island had been out there, so far out over so much choppy water. Far beyond the last gray wave, the groaning ice when there was ice, the fog when there was fog. So distant in the middle of such a huge lake that for their first 9 years, Niji, that church made of those tens of thousands of wooden pegs, each one as small as a little boy's finger bones. Those wood shingled domes like tops upended to spin their points on the floor of the sky, the priest's black robes snapping in the wind, their beards blowing with the clouds, their droning ceaseless as the shore slap waves, might have been just another fairy tale that Dyadya Avia told. And then one day, when the lake ice had broken and geese had come again, two brothers, twins, stole a little boat and rowed together out towards Niji. Into the lake, Dima said. To hunt the Chudo-Yudo, Yarik said. Until they found it, Dima said. And killed it, Yarik said. They were 10 years old, Dmitry Lvovich Zhivov and Yaroslav Lvovich Zhivov. and they had never been this far out in the lake, this lost, this on their own. Around them, the water was wide as a second sky, darkening beneath the one above, the rowboat a moon sliver winking on the waves. In it, they sat side by side, hands buried in the pockets of their coats, leaning slightly into each other with each sway of the skiff. Or maybe it came up, Dima said, and crushed the boat, and they drowned, Yarik said. Or Dima said it ate them. They grinned, the same grin at the same time, as if one's cheeks tugged the other's lips. Or Yarik started and Dima finished. They died. They went quiet. The low slap of lake water knocking the metal hull. The small, sharp calls of Jaegers, black specks swirling against a frostbitten sky. But no wood blades clacking at the rowboat's side, no worn handles creaking in the locks. Hours ago, they had lost the oars. Now they were losing last light. Their boat had drifted so far into Lake Otseva's center that they could no longer make out the shore, but there was the island. All their lives, it had been somewhere beyond the edge of sight, and now they watched it, far gray glimpse growing darker as if the roots of its unknown woods were drawing night up from the earth. It humped blackly out of the distant water, unreachable as a whale's back, and beyond it stretched the lake, and all around the lake, and beneath them, the rocking of its waves. At their feet, the tools they'd taken scraped back and forth against the skiff floor, axe, hatchet, cleaver, pick, each one freshly sharpened. In the bow, behind their backs, a brush hook's moon-bright blade swayed against the sky, beneath it a cloud of netting, and nestled there to keep from breaking, wrapped in wool blankets to warm the life in them, two dozen eggs, a gestating nestful of yolky souls. Out of the stern, the fishing rod jutted, its line lipped by the waves, tugged and slacked, going down, 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 into the black belly of the lake where its huge hook hung, gripping in its barb the red fist of a fresh goose heart. Way out over the water, far beyond the island, the edge of the lake met the end of the world, and there the sky was a thin red line drawn by a bead of blood. Then it was just a line. Then the line was gone, and there was just the darkness of the earth meeting the darkness of the sky, and the boys rose unsteadily on the unsteady boat and crouched atop the netting, unfolding the blankets from the eggs. Dima unscrewed the tops from the canning jars. Yarik cracked the shells against their rims. One by one, he slid in each yolk on its slick of albumen. One by one, Dima closed the tops again. When they had all the eggs in all the jars, they tied threads around the glass necks. Each thread they tied to an oarlock or a hole punched through the gunwale or a ring at the prow, the two brothers crawling around the boat, reaching over its edge, letting go the jars. At the end of their strings, they floated, the glass gleaming, the eggs like a lake full of eyes. How many heads do you think it has? Dima said. It had become more night than dusk, and there was no moon, no way to see the fishing line, but they watched the rod. At least six, Yarik said. Probably 12, Dima said. Yarik told him, 24. Dima said, I want the axe. Reaching down, he found it, and arms thin as the handle, shoulders straining, lifted. Beside him in Yarik's small boy's hands, their old uncle's pistol seemed huge. They sat huddled together, cold and silent, and knowing the other was scared, the line would snap tight, the boat would jerk, the weight would suck down the stern, the water would wolf their feet, the thing's two dozen heads would roar up around the boat, one set of jaws mouthing blood and metal, the other 23 agape, their tongues, their teeth. What if it doesn't come? Dima said. That was when the rod bent. They watched it arc, watched the arc deepen until the rod was almost doubled on itself, shaking. It's going to, Dima whispered, and Yarik said, break. And Dima said, come loose, and then the stern dropped so fast that for a moment there was just the strain of all the air cupped within the boat against all the water trying to suck it down, the sound of something splitting, tearing. And then the boat jerked back up, its stern lifting off the surface, knocking the boys forward, noses to knees, and when they looked up, the rod was gone. Stumbling to his feet, Dima stood scanning the water for a hint of the rod streaking away or hurtling back at them. The boat wall boomed. He jerked, ripped a hand off the axe, flailed for the gunwale. Behind Dima, his brother laughing. Even in the dark, he could see the panic on Yarik's face, the unnerved giddiness in his eyes as he banged the metal barrel on the boat side again. Trusichka, Yarik called him. He tried to make clucking noises as he bobbed his head, but he was laughing too hard. Only sputtering came out. The laughter passed from Yarik to Dima as these things always passed, as if the placentas that had once fed them were still conjoined. And Dima climbed onto the rowboat seat, shakily stood, threw back his face, and crowed a laughter-rippled rooster's call. Kukuraku! Yarik climbed beside him, crowed out his own. Kukuraku! On the thin metal bench, they stood side by side, beating their chests, calling into the night. From the night, a call came back at them. some rooster of Niji crowing its reply. Such a long sound, so drawn out and furious, they counted it, raz, dva, tri, 15, 16, 17, longer even than Dyadi Abu's old crower, longer than they could push their own breath when they emptied their lungs in a wild burst of crowing back. How the rooster bellowed his challenge again at them, how they threw their crowing boys and bird across the black surface of the lake, until their crows turned to shouts, their shouts back to laughter, the laughter to breathing, the breathing quieting. They stood there rocking. Above them, the stars filled the sky like sand filling a bucket of water until it seemed wholly comprised of grains of light. Below it, a surface filled with their reflection. All around the boat, the floating jars gleamed, a drifting constellation waterborne. What if it comes back? Yarik said. And they passed between them the knowledge that that was why they had come out, for it to come back, so they could kill it. They stood thinking of their father and how he must have tried, and they passed between them the truth that he had failed and that they would fail too. And they wondered again silently the thoughts they had wondered aloud in the night, in their beds at Dyadia Avia's, where in them lived their souls. And had they grown side by side, same to same, in their mother's womb as well? And if one was swallowed up or died or simply left, would the other go too? And then they climbed down off the seat and went around the boat again, Dima with his axe, Yark with the cleaver, cutting all the strings. One by one, the jars floated away. The gleams separated from each other, the darkness between the boys and the boat widened and widened, and then swallowed any sign of the jars at all. Out to see Niji, Dima tried, and after a moment into the lake, and then where they sank and the water swallowed them up and they drowned. Dima grinned, waiting to feel his brother's grin, but his brother was clamoring for one side of the boat and Dima was scrambling to the other to keep from tipping, and into the darkness that somewhere hid the island, Yarik was shouting, "Help! Help!" And I'll stop there.
So I remember, as I hear you reading that opening passage, I remember my first experience of reading that, and my first thought was, this is a strange world, and yet it's a strangely familiar world. Huh. And that sensation continued throughout the novel. What inspired you to write this book?
Oh, you know, it was really, there's so many parts of the book. The different aspects of it were inspired by different things. The core of it in the book is the love between the brothers and the story about the brothers. And that's really what I wanted to explore and what led me to write this book. So I have a brother. He's 5 years older than I am. When I was about 4 or 5, my parents got divorced, and I wound up, he became a very, very important figure in my life. Kind of half father figure, half older brother, then morphed into just older brother and best bud and onward from there. And there was a time all the way up through maybe when I was in my mid-20s where he was the most important person in my life and I was the most important mm-hmm. person in his life. And then that shifted. He got married, he had a daughter. I'm now married, I have a stepdaughter, I have a son on the way. And figuring out how I could hold on to my relationship with him mm-hmm. and yet being forced to change it, as life forces us to kind of change our relationships with people, was a very painful and difficult thing for me. And so I wrestled with that for a long time. And luckily, he and I love each other very much. We're very close. It's all great. But that was a real struggle for me. And so I wanted to write about that. So at the core, that's mm-hmm. that I hope is maybe what makes it feel familiar, is it's coming from just mm-hmm. a human struggle or wound or whatever you want to call it in me that I wanted to write about. Why it's set in Russia and that kind of very unfamiliar aspect of this springs from a whole bunch of different things, which we can maybe talk about, that I've always wanted to write about Russia. It's been in me for a long time for various reasons. And then also the space mirrors that are such an important part of this book mm-hmm. were something that actually Russia actually sent up in an experiment in 1993. And so I always thought of this story as having to be set there. It seemed like such a Russian thing to do, this crazy idea, the same way that the Soviets, you know, there was a long project to reverse the flow of rivers that they did, or drill a hole to the center of the earth. There were these grand things that felt like the world of this book felt Soviet to me, felt like it would spring from the Soviet way of thinking and from the Russian kind of history behind that. So I think the combination of those things maybe led to that.
So let's talk a little bit more about Russia, because obviously that's an aspect of the book that I was very drawn to. And I was skeptical before I started reading this.
Me too. Before I started writing.
Well, you know, was he going to capture Russia? Was he going to capture a sense of the Russia that I know, not just the Soviet Russia, but... And what's so amazing about this book is that it's not just the atmosphere of Soviet Russia and post-Soviet Russia, but it is drenched in Russian fairy tales and fables and a sense of kind of deep Russian tradition. And I found that quite amazing. And you wrote, a few weeks ago, Josh wrote an article in the live section in the New York Times called Looking for the Russia I Once Knew, about your time as an exchange student in Russia and how it had changed when you returned. Talk a little more about your relationship with this place called Russia and how that has influenced your writing life in this book in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty complicated, as you can imagine. But my family on my mother's side is all half, that half of my family is Russian. So it was my great-grandfather who came over from Russia, so a few generations removed. But I grew up with a lot of Russian foods, with, you know, even dancing, you know, to folk music and stuff like that with my mom. She put the records on, be a little kid. And, you know, so I had that in my background, right, first of all. So there was an interest in that. Then, when I was in sixth grade, the girl who I had a crush on decided that when she went to junior high school in seventh, she was going to take Russian language. And so, of course, I took Russian language so I could be in the same class with her. And that was really the thing that set me on this path that was the most influential thing in my entire junior high and high school experience, because I wound up studying Russian language for 6 years, and being part of the Russian club and studying Russian culture and putting on these festivals to raise money where I dance, and my brother and I would dance Cossack in the Cossack dancing competitions. We'd always win, and which is in this book too. And so, you know, so that was a kind of big influential part of my life right at that time in our lives when we're forming who we are as people, all the way up until I was 18. And then in the midst of that, like you mentioned, I went when I was 14, I went to the Soviet Union as an exchange student, lived with the host family in a kind of working class city way in the far north near the Finnish border, in an area called Karelia. And that, at 14, was the first time I'd done anything like that and been exposed to a culture that different as a teenager, as a person who I could kind of approach it on my own and through my own vision, not as a kid being taken by my parents. And so that opened up my world too. So I always knew I wanted to write about Russia, but I didn't feel that I had a way in. My writing didn't really go there for many, many years. And it was really just, I was working on another story, a short story. Before that even, I was listening to NPR, working on something totally different. And I was down in a cabin near Blacksburg on the border with West Virginia that my dad and brother and I built, and where I wrote all of The New Valley. And I probably hadn't seen anybody for a month, because I do that when I'm down there. I had a big beard. I was going kind of crazy. So I was listening to NPR. It was my company. And there was a professor at Virginia Tech who'd written a book on the history of nighttime. I don't know if you all know of it. At Day's Close, it's called. It's great. And in this interview, he just happened to mention, he's throwing off kind of various weird ways that mankind has approached nighttime. He said, oh, and the Russians in 1993 sent these satellites up to try to reflect light down into a city and light it 24/7 and abolish nighttime. And then he kept talking, and I was just sitting there like, that is the craziest thing I've ever heard. You know, it was just nuts. And what would that mean to have no nighttime and all that? So that was my way in. I felt that I had to set this story in Russia if I was going to deal with that. And so it combined in ways that become clear in the novel with the story of the brothers and twins, and they work opposite shifts, one during a mirror light shift, one during a daytime shift. And mm-hmm. the way that the mirrors, again, like I said, kind of put the pressure on who they are. So it was all of that was in the mix with Russia. I went back in 2010 to do research as well. So I was there a little bit more recently.
So that idea of the space mirrors, even though it's rooted in reality, it's a pretty bold conceit for a novel. And one of the things that you mentioned in your description of today's talk, which is actually called the risks and rewards of writing what you don't know, is that by entering that kind of unfamiliar territory as an artist, the territory that's unfamiliar to you, that is actually a way to enhance your artistry, to sharpen your vision. So what are some aspects of this book that were unfamiliar to you, and that when you entered into that territory allowed for an even sharper vision of what it is you're trying to show.
Well, part of it is, you know, there's that the whole, that old chestnut, write what you know, which a lot of people have probably heard, and which hopefully has been debunked and put in its place, because I don't believe in it at all. But I do believe in what Eudora Welty said. I'll try to get this right. And I think it was, write what you don't know about what you know. I think that's right. It might have been, write what you know about what you don't know. But I think it's the first one. I think it's the first one. I think both work, and that's why I get them confused. I think that for writing, I think that as long as there's some element, you want some element that you understand. It might be the external world. It might be the internal world. So for me, with this novel, it was I knew that the thing that was going on between the brothers emotionally, right? So that was what I knew. But by stepping away from, if I had said it in my life with my brother A, I wouldn't have felt that I could write it because it would have been too close, right? So I would have been stifled by the realities of the situation with my brother. By setting it somewhere so drastically different, it opens up a kind of forthrightness and a bravery for me as a writer that I can go at that thing that I do know, which is the emotional core of it. So I think that's one of the things I think is so important about stepping beyond kind of your known world. The other thing is that it forces you, by stepping outside of your known and familiar world, it forces you to use your imagination and to use your imagination in such a way that it has to take on the responsibility that your just memory or your observation might do in your own life. And I think that leads then to a certain vibrancy in life in fiction, because you're having to dig down with the same specificity or greater specificity that you would in describing your own world. And so I think that, you know, those are both important. When you asked what aspect of this was really stepping out that way, the truth is, we're setting it with Russian characters in Russia was the biggest part of that. You know, I mean, the space mirrors, sure, I had to deal with, well, what's it like when there's no darkness, right? That's different. But the thing that scared me the most, and that was most difficult for me to kind of go head on at, was this idea that I'm going to write something set. It's not an American character's view on Russia, right? Which would be a different and kind of easier thing to grapple with, but actual Russian characters set in Russia. And so that's partially why the fables come into play so much. I didn't feel, and I don't feel at all, that this book that I had a right to, or that I could, even more than that, a right to, just I could, write something that was going to reveal the Russian soul today, right? Or was going to be an accurate representation of, you know, what you would find if you go to Russia now in all ways. It springs from that, and it equally springs from fables, and it also springs from my memories of when I was 14, which are probably as unreliable as fables. And all of that, all mingled together, creates a Russia that I think is hopefully redolent of Russia in a way that feels authentic and real, but is also unique to my imagination, if that makes sense.
Well, that's one of the things about the book that struck me. I thought you had gone back and spent time in Russia and researched. I mean, was this just a matter of memory and imagination, or was there research?
There was some research. There are various aspects of the books that I did research. So, you know, the role of oligarchs and the way that Russia was in the early 90s when capitalism kind of exploded there, and there was this unfettered cowboy capitalism that happened and people were making $1 million overnight. I knew kind of about that. I had a friend who had actually been in my Russian class in high school who'd gone over there, and that had happened to him. He had become very wealthy, living in Moscow, and so I could talk with him, but I also did some book research, you know, read some stuff about the oligarchs and how they came to be who they were. So there was some research like that. The first draft, though, I did very little research. I was relying on my own memories, on fables that I remembered, on what I'd absorbed as a kid, and I did that very purposefully. The first draft was very different from the second draft. Between the first and second, I went to Russia in 2010, and I spent about 3 weeks backpacking and camping in rural Russia, mostly in rural Russia. Also stayed with this friend of mine in Moscow, drove around like 100 miles per hour in a Porsche and saw a totally different side of Moscow. And, you know, his kid is like taken to school by a bodyguard in an armored car. Like, you know, it's that kind of a thing. But most of the time I spent back in the same host city that I'd been to as a kid. And I lived with the teacher who had been the English teacher in the Soviet school and had brought the Soviet students over. I lived with her, so saw her 20 years later and stayed with her and her husband for a couple weeks and spent a lot of time in that city, and also pushed myself to get out of the Russia that that we see on the TV, which meant getting into rural Russia. Mm-hmm. Meant getting went across a very 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 large lake there, Lake Onega, which the lake here is based upon, called Otseva. It's not that different in the book, but I went across to a region where nobody really goes too much, a logging region, and wound up just kind of meeting people there by hitchhiking and wandering around, and spent the night with a kind of peasant family, that kind of thing, that informed the book dramatically.
So in addition to being very redolent of Russia, as you say, at a really core level, this book is also just a good story.
I'm glad to hear that.
And a good story in the sense that I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know whether they, now don't worry, I'm not going to reveal any plot details. I didn't know if the two brothers were going to get back to Yadya Avia's farm. I was guessing, and then what ended up happening was totally unexpected. And so layered onto, you know, so all the evocative atmospheric elements that you've just described about Russia were actually just layered onto something that was just a damn good story. So how did you think about the story arc? Is that something that you had planned ahead of time? At what point in the writing process does that become clear to you? What's going to happen?
I'm different from a lot of literary writers in that I actually outline the entire thing before I start. And that's often frowned upon. If anybody is in an MFA program, you've probably been told not to do that. I was told not to do that and tried not to do that while I was studying at Columbia, and just found it's just not the way my head works. So when I was told not to do that, all I was doing was trying to outline inside my head and not write it down and getting confused. So for me, the ending of a story almost never changes. It's what I'm writing towards. It's the purpose for the story. So in this, the ending that I arrive at, I knew emotionally, the complexity, hopefully, of that emotional place, mm-hmm. was where I wanted to get to. And the story was really about where do I start in order to take that arc to that place. And because of that, structuring it becomes very, very important. And there are a lot of different threads. And I wind up printing out, you know, for a book of this length, it was probably a 15-page, single-spaced outline that is scene by scene going through. Now, the key to that, I actually teach a course called the organic outline. And what I mean by that is that it's an outline that is arrived at naturally out of the character's concerns, first of all. And secondly, as I wrestle with those concerns and learn the world, I'm constantly changing it. So I print the outline out, and then I've got a pen. And first of all, I've probably thought about this for a year and scribbled in notebooks and what almost to me feels like a first draft, but just kind of thinking about it. None of that writing will actually make it into a thing. But then when I print the outline out, I'm constantly, as I'm writing a scene, well, it changes then. Oh, well, now that I've done this thing in the scene, I'm going to have to, you know, I'll flip through a few pages and say, oh, well, this would be great now if this scene, you know, halfway through my outline tied back to what I just wrote, even though I didn't know it was going to be this way. So by the time I've been writing for a week, the outline is covered in scribbles. I retype it. I print it out again. I do the same thing kind of constantly. So it's a constantly kind of shifting outline, but I have to feel like I know where I'm going with it, or else I feel stuck in what I'm writing. I don't know why I'm writing the scene. And a lot of creative writing teachers, and this is, I should first of all say that this is how I write. I mean, everyone here who writes knows that you write differently than whoever the person sitting next to you is who writes. And so I never try to tell my students you should do this, but this is just what works for me. But so I print the outline out. I've got all the scribbles on it. I let it shift that way, and I forget where I was going with that. That's the important part. That's
well,
all.
Over lunch, you said something interesting. You said there was a character in this book in a storyline, which is really central to the book, that you weren't planning on initially. It's the character of the billionaire Bazarov, who is the owner of this giant glass greenhouse. So how did that? At what point did you realize you had to add that to the storyline?
That was in the second draft. And what happened between the first draft and the second draft is I realized that the emotional arc that I wanted between the brothers was there, that I'd written that out. What I had left out was the entire plot that would actually make that emotional arc happen. So it was a good friend of mine you know, had read the draft. I always end up giving it to two or three friends to read and give me criticism. And he said to me, you know, I think this is working. I love it, but it's, you know, all, it's essentially, you it's like you're jumping from the emotional movement in a character movement in a story to character movement, but we're missing all the connective tissue in between that is the plot in this. And that made absolute sense to me. And I realized that I could probably write something like that, but I would have to crunch it down into something that was purposely not meant to be very plot-oriented at all and not very narrative. And it would be a novella. This thing was about 200 pages at this point. But I also realized that it wasn't going to... I'd be squeezing it down to such an extent that it wouldn't be reaching what I wanted it to reach. And so my other option was to say, okay, I've got this 200-page thing that is kind of lacking a plot. You know, what happens now when I start to think about, okay, what are the natural ways that these changes come about with the brothers? And Bazarov, I call him Bazarov, is that...
It's okay, call him, you're the author.
Yeah, well, is that wrong? Is that
call me Baz.
Baz.
he does say, call me Baz.
Call
but,
me Baz.
Well, you can tell me afterwards if I'm wrong.
Were you drawing on Turgenev's character?
I was, yes.
Okay,
his
name is Bazarov.
Okay, I'm going to call him Bazarov then. I have to adjust that.
I think Bazarov is more interesting, honestly. But but that was clever. Yeah.
All right, well, I'll call him Baz. But so Baz was, he was there, really he's the plot instigator in many ways. And he becomes the antagonist. And he became the figure that was going to push the plot elements that I needed in a kind of natural way, force it upon this story in a way that it was very important to me that it didn't just feel layered on top of the story, obviously, but that these elements of the plot would naturally give rise to the movements that I knew I wanted the characters to take. Of course, in writing another 400 pages, which I did that summer, you know, the character movements shifted too, of course, and all that became interwoven, hopefully completely interconnectedly.
He's he's an awesome character. I'm very glad you added him, because one of the reviews, I can't remember where, but one of the many reviews that this book has received, LA Times, New York Times, Washington Post, said that this character, Bazarov, who was just happened to be added in the second draft, stole almost every scene that he was in. It's just, I mean, it's amazing.
He's doing bad stuff. Right, so that makes him fun, and he's literally stealing. So you know, those kinds of characters, the character that goes in and messes things up, is a really fun character to write. You know, because everything that character does is going to have dramatic import, and so because that character is that rooted in what in kind of innately carries that dramatic action with what he does, the character is kind of free to do things. In all kinds of ways, it frees up the kind of character. Because I guess what I'm saying is, because the character's actions are guaranteed, because that's his purpose, to link in naturally, dramatically to the story. You have a lot of freedom with a writer with what you can do with that character. Then he can be crazy in many different ways. He can be flamboyant. He can be whatever, because his actions are grounded in what the story needs, so it doesn't feel extraneous.
That's an interesting explanation. So here's one paradox that I still can't figure out. And being a teacher of literature, I'm always thinking about ideas and themes. And so I hate to do this to you, but So as I started reading, I thought this was going to be a kind of dystopian social commentary on the evils of capitalism and greed and all that. Mm. And that's in the book. That's clearly in the book. Bazarov represents a lot of that. And yet when I think about the ultimate embodiment of capitalism in this book, the great glass sea itself, it is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So I am as moved by this image of this product of capitalism as I am by all of the references to Russian tradition. Was that unintentional? Did you always know that the Great Glass Sea would be beautiful?
I mean, in a way, it had to be. Maybe part of it is my weakness as a writer. I mean, when I'm presented, everyone knows when the Great Glass Sea refers to something called the Orangeria.
That's great.
Okay. but the...
Where I come off correcting
you? No. But the Orangeria is essentially the largest greenhouse in the world. And so because there's constant light, there's this perpetual production of crop production, essentially, that goes on. And so it stretches for acres and acres and acres, as far as you can see, like a massive sea, essentially, but made of glass, covering rivers and everything else beneath it. So, you know, when you're dealing with that, if you can't, you know, either you've got to really resist making it beautiful. You know, it's like I forget who it was, but the cinematographer for Lawrence of Arabia. Anyone know who that is? Someone said how beautiful it was, and he says, I was out in the desert. All you have to do is point the camera, you know, and in the right light, and you give yourself something like that, and, you know, as minute you start describing it, it's going to start to feel beautiful, the way the light's going to hit it, the way that it's going to mess with the world. So when you have a sunset, is it going to be a strip of the sunset color and reflecting in like a line across the second horizon? There's all kinds of stuff you can do with it. So it was just fun with that. But I think the other thing is, like you say, with the way that I talk about capitalism and communism and some of these kind of bigger ideas, it was really important to me to keep them complicated and to not kind of lay down some kind of pat idea that mm-hmm. I claim to have some solution, or that I claim to know that this thing was wrong. I mean, kind of anyone who comes out with their, in the book, who spouts philosophy, economic philosophy, or any, is kind of foolish or shown to be wrong in one way or another. So it was important to me that I wasn't an author trying to say I have this answer, but more that I was exploring the complexity of these different issues, all of which have bad sides. And the same thing with Dora Angeria, which represents this kind of perpetual growth of capitalism. It's constantly being expanded, and there's constant productivity underneath it. I wouldn't have wanted that to be, if that was just a dark and foreboding and non-beautiful thing, it would have felt too simplistic in mm-hmm. the same way that the approaching that idea in that way would have been.
Yeah, there's no one of the things I mentioned earlier is that all these characters are real. There's no villain, there's no heroes. And so as a literature teacher, one of the abstractions that I would bring to that is I would say, well, here's an author who's showing us something very important about human nature, that all of our dreams have validity. That even Bazarov's dream of this giant glass house is a dream that has its own beauty to it. And so, anyway, so that's how I would think about this book, and mm-hmm. simply from a different angle. Mm-hmm. I like how you described it probably a little better. So let me ask you one more question, and then I think we'll open it up to the audience. So start thinking about what you're most inspired to ask, Josh. But you said in an interview in 2012 that the one thing that links all of your fiction together is that they, quote, they all deal with humankind's attempt, both metaphorically and actually, to increase the amount of light in the world. Mm. Tell us more about what you meant by that.
Well, first of all, I don't think I meant all of my fiction by it. But
I probably misquoted.
But I kind of wish I did know. That would sound great. But it does link, it was totally accurate quote, but what I think I probably was referring to is I have three books that I've been working on now for a long time. And all of that work, so not The New Valley, but The Great Glass Sea, and then two books that are coming, are all linked by that idea. And that really just got out of control. I mean, it was, initially I'd heard this thing about the space mirrors that I mentioned on NPR. And I wrote a short story 7 years ago or something, a long time ago, that was actually set in Vermont, about these kids, one of whom happens to be Serbian, and they're waiting to see this in 1993, this test satellite go over in the sky. So I wrote that short story and thought, okay, surely I'm done with this, but I couldn't quite let go of the idea, and I became fascinated with trying to deal with this attempt to eliminate darkness from someplace, and it felt just very rich, both metaphorically and also just kind of descriptively, and it felt like the material, that there was a lot there. Why would people feel the need to do this? What have we done? I remember flying on a plane and looking at all the lights down. I'm sure most people have done this. And my reaction when I look at all of the lights scattered all over is often, what have we done to this world? It's made it so alien in many ways when I look down on it. And so I became interested in just what all the stuff that I could do with that kind of broad of a material to deal with. Lightness and dark and humankind's attempt over many centuries to diminish the darkness and increase the amount of light. So the novel deals with that. The novel was originally going to be a short story in a collection called The Age of Perpetual Light. which also it starts in 1901 with some early kind of electrification of rural America and towns in rural America, going all the way up into a future when America is lit by space mirrors of the kind that they're experimented with in this novel. And I approach lightness and light and dark in all different kind of ways throughout that collection. So again, so that collection kind of came, the novel came. One of the stories actually was published in VQR just this summer. The editor is here. And that will be in the collection too. It's called Long Bright Line. I think it's online if you guys want to take a look at it. And so then there's, after that though, I found I'd written a novella around a similar theme. I wrote it while I was in Egypt, of all things. I was on a grant there for a year trying to write a different novel. This is often how it works for me. I'm trying to write one thing and I'm banging my head against the wall with it. And there's this little part of me that gets excited about another story back here, you know? And so I like keep working, working, and then I say, oh, the heck with it. And I go and I bang out something in like a week. And so that's happened with this, and I wrote a novella, and then I thought, well, crap, now I've got all these stories. I've got a novella. I've got to write two more novellas because I want to have a collection of novellas. And luckily, these ideas came for novellas around the same theme. So now I'm winding up with a trilogy, essentially, with a novel, a story collection, and a novella collection that all is kind of roped together by that idea. That was a long answer. But I'll keep my answer shorter, I promise, for anybody else who might have questions. Cliff.
So one thing that's unique about you is the illustrations that you do for both your first book and this book. Talk about that.
Cool. Yeah, the first book, I'd always been interested in illustrations, largely because of reading Sebald, W.G. Sebald, for any of you who've read him, and the way he uses a lot of photographs, but also charts and different kinds of stuff. He'll place them within a text, and they have a fluidity to your experience and the way you deal with them. You see them coming, they often will refer to something that's on the next page, so there's less of a hard line than the way that we experience something with just text. So I was interested in that, and in my first book, the middle novella, required that, I felt. And I think it's really, really important with illustration or with anything that in fiction that you're only doing it because the story demands it. So the middle novella is about 100 pages long, and in that, time gets all messed up. And the character's experience of time, the character is beginning to have dementia, and it needed to shift out of something that felt like our usual experience of time. And so I didn't want the hard breaks of chapters. Instead, I wanted the way that an image would allow us to flip back and forth between things, you see it coming, all that kind of stuff. So I wound up doing drawings for that. And that allowed Grove. Grove was my press, and they were luckily kind enough to let me do that. And then with this, because I knew I could do the drawings with Grove, I always imagined that there would be drawings in this book, largely because approaching it from the sensibility of a fable was so important to me. And I wanted to try to place the reader in that world of a fable immediately and as subtly as possible, so not trying to hit the reader over the head necessarily with the language of it, but have just the illustrations kind of move the reader into that zone. And just one last thing I'll say about these is they're inspired by the work of Ivan Bilibin, who was a Russian illustrator working about a century ago. And for me, when I think of Russian fables, it's completely inextricable from Bilibin's illustrations. So again, I wanted that kind of that feeling. So yeah, I did about 2 months solid illustrating for the book. Yeah?
Going back to your idea of like light and darkness, and you know, you said it's about people's attempt to create more light, but then you said like riding in an airplane, looking down, that the extra light makes things seem alien.
Yeah.
So do you have this sort of, it's not like all light is good, all darkness is bad, but sort of a nuanced view of
light? Yeah, absolutely. I try to do that, you know, approach it. There are some stories, a lot of this is light is representative of something else in the story. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's knowledge. There's the story that ends the collection. It's called The First Bad Thing, and it was published in American Short Fiction. And in this world of where America is lit by these space mirrors and there's no darkness, it's really a love story about two people who are trying to hold on to not knowing about each other as the thing that keeps them in love. And so that kind of, I'm using the way that they live in this world of constant light to try to play with that too. So it takes on all these different kind of roles.
So on the airplane, towards the end of the book,
yeah.
As they're flying to Moscow, Yarik has this moment where he sees the one tree, the aspen tree, that has survived where many of the other trees can't handle 24/7
mm-hmm.
light.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this gorgeous sort of image that you convey.
Mm-hmm.
And is there, should I read something else into that?
Yes. always.
So, like, what might I think the tree is symbolizing? Because it's powerful.
Well, I'm really glad that you picked up on that. That was actually something that my editor and I talked about cutting. It became really, really important to me as a representative of Dima in some ways. So that tree is aberrant. Its genes are tweaked and messed up just enough that it doesn't have the photoperiodic gene that relies on darkness and the different darkness of light to let it know when to flower, when to leaf out. So because it doesn't have that, it actually survives despite not having these things. And Dima is a character that doesn't fit at all within the world that he is living in. And so he also feels to me like he is both flawed and messed up in a way that makes him not really able to operate in the world, but at the same time, that's his saving grace, and that's the thing that allows him to be who he is. So the survival of that one tree becomes important. It's actually referred to again at the very end of the book, and becomes kind of an important thing there. So I'm really glad you noticed that. Thank you. Yeah.
So when you were incorporating the fables into the book, did that just sort of happen, like the themes, they just come out naturally, or were they like very intentionally put in?
The fables themselves, like the specific Russian fables?
Yeah, like the themes of those specific ones.
Yeah, yeah. It was a combination of both, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I knew there would be these fables. I knew that, say, the Chudo Yudo was going to be important in the beginning, in the part of the scene that I read, in part because in Russian folklore, there's a fable of the Chudo Yudo leaping up and swallowing the sun. And then Ivan Popolyov, who, am I pronouncing that right? Popolyov. Okay, Ivan Popolyov, often referred to as Ivan the Fool in Russian fables, has to go out and try to like kill the Chudo Yudo. And so I knew there were elements like that I knew, okay, this is going to be part of the story. I thought about it and it fit what I wanted to do. But then, you know, the character of Ivan becomes linked to Dima in some ways, and different things would happen in the plot that would allow me to bring in other elements of folklore. So it's a mixture. Like
mm-hmm.
I think hopefully anything when you're writing is that, you know, you maybe have one idea, but then it leads to something else that naturally is brought in that ties to it. But, you know, although I said I've got everything planned out, like I also said, I'm discovering constantly that what I've planned out is wrong.
Yeah.
All right, then I have something.
Okay. Well,
it's more of a statement or a praise than a question.
Good. everybody think of one of those.
So I was there in 2005 when we were on a boat. So we went from Moscow to St. Petersburg on a boat, and then we would stop at little villages along the way.
Hmm.
And I don't remember the name of the village. I have a picture of the church that looks almost identical to the one you described.
Hmm.
And we would get off and we would walk in. I mean, it was all wood and
yep.
very shiny
mm-hmm.
in that natural sheen of wood that didn't look like it had ever been painted, just
yep.
right down the water. And, you know, when I read your book, I was so moved by how much it really fit my perception, having read a lot and studied and been there twice, Soviet Union and Russia. And it was just powerful. All of the, and then the piece where he is climbing up on that statue to read the masters and seeing those people come back in, because we got some language and conversation mixed in little lectures we would get on this tour about the people who were not surviving or not thriving, shall we say, after the end of communism. And we would see these little old ladies, these little shrunken
yeah.
little old ladies selling weeds, in essence, who hadn't managed to sort of find their way in this new country.
Mm-hmm.
And I could just kind of see those people going back and listening to that. And I just want to say how, you know, how powerful a story it was, and how really it felt that essence of not an American book plopped down in Russia, like you talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. That's just, I'm glad to hear all that.
I'll second that. That's why it was really quite amazing. I thought you would just been writing it in Russia, and so that's the power of paying attention and
imagination. I mean, honestly, for those of you who are writers, it is amazing how right you are when you guess. It's something I discovered when I was I mentioned I was in Egypt, and I was there doing research for, I had a Fulbright to research a novel that was a historical novel set in the 1870s in Egypt. And I researched the heck out of it. I spent, you know, I was in all these rare books libraries, and I was doing experiential research out in the Western desert, and kind of all just so overloaded with research that I found that the story was being directed by the research, and I was trying to fit things in a way that was killing it, and B, I found that my creativity with it was squelched, that I felt tied to and had a certain fealty to the research and the true facts in a way that didn't allow me to imagine what I was doing. So with this book, like I said, I very purposely didn't do a lot of research with that first draft, and I think that for different writers, it's very different. I know Charles Frazier goes to the library and just kind of wanders through and picks out facts and things, and they give life to his ideas, and that's great. But for me, and everyone should kind of find your own place with this, but for me, too much research can really squelch it. So what I discovered, though, was 90% of what I guessed at, kind of guessed at right, because it's a lot of it is just kind of things that would naturally make sense, you know, and then you can go through and you can weed out the stuff that's wrong, you know, the way that the Russians make their tea, I'd remembered it kind of wrong. So when I was back there, I noticed that, they make their tea differently. I better change that, you know, but it's not something that should keep you from moving on with your writing and your story, that kind of thing. Yes.
So this outlining process you mentioned, did that apply to your first draft that was just about the brothers?
Yes, it did. So that applied to the first draft. The first draft, I thought I was writing a short story, so obviously the outline shifted dramatically. At first, I thought I was writing a short story. I got through the first scene. It was about 15 pages long. I thought, either this is not the way to start this thing, or it's not a short story. And then I started writing that, and I thought, well, it's probably a novella. And I got about 60, 70 pages in, going along the new outline that I created, and realized there were these holes that really were needed to be filled in and supported characters. The mother became a very important character, and I hadn't prepped her at all, essentially, throughout the first half of what I was writing. And so I thought, well, okay, got to go back and do that. And that's how it wound up being, essentially, you know, taking it a novel length. So it was a constant process, like I say, of adjusting. But I did have a sense of part of what that does. This is what I was going to say before, and I said I forgot what I was going to say. Part of what that does, a lot of the criticism of outlining, and again, I can't stress enough, this is all depends on what works for you. It might stifle your creativity. But part of the criticism is that then it makes your writing stiff and kind of takes the life out of it because the discovery doesn't happen on the page, right? For me, having a scaffold of where I'm going actually allows that discovery to feel to me more organic, more natural. It's akin to when I was, a friend of mine is here from when I was in college, and I actually was studying film, and I was doing some directing kind of classes and workshops, and it's more akin to saying, okay, you have some actors and you know what the purpose of this scene has to be, and then you're going to let them kind of come up with exactly how it happens so that the life comes into the characters in their improv, right? And it feels very much like that with me when I'm writing. So if I know, as a director, I often feel more like a director than a writer in some ways. I feel like I know, okay, this is what's got to happen in the scene. This is where we need to go. Go do it, guys, right? And it's very exciting to see how the character's going to do that. And so there's a freshness there for me that if I don't know where they're going to go, then it's just me like sitting with the guys like, what do we do now? You know? And it doesn't really feel like it has any impetus.
It's a great image. One more question, maybe? And then let's buy some books.
Yes.
Do you ever have a character tell you to make changes?
Yes, absolutely. That happened halfway through the second draft in this. I've written about 200 extra pages, and there was a scene where, and we were talking about this earlier today, actually, there's a scene where Yarik, one of the brothers, is brought to Moscow. He's surrounded by, he's meeting with, for various reasons, he's meeting with a bunch of oligarchs, very powerful men. They're surrounded by all of the oligarchs' bodyguards, who are all armed. Yark has a pistol on him. I knew that was going to happen. What I didn't know is that at one point, Yark was going to reach and try to pull the pistol out, which seemed like a very foolish thing to do when he's surrounded by armed men. And I kind of watched him do that when he did that. And I sat back and I thought, you fool, you didn't just do that, did you? You know, what's going to happen now? And then I had to think, well, okay, was this a mistake? You know, was this me kind of being misguided, or was the character trying to tell me something, and that the character would naturally, in that moment, that would be the character's action. And so I went for a run, just often what I do when I got to think things through, and I realized, okay, how is this action going to play out? The gun, if this gun is going to actually be used, or almost used in some way, bigger than I'd imagined, that gun had to be threaded through the entire story, and I saw it slot itself in a way that felt right for the rest of the story. And so that's when I knew, okay, that was the character telling me to do something. And the character was right. That was the natural move for the character to make. And then I had to adjust from there. So that became a big part of the story. And that was purely Yark doing it. That wasn't me. So, I mean, it was me, kind of, too.
Awesome. So I'm sure you're happy to sign books.
I would love to.
Chat some more.
Yeah. Thank you very much.